So this is a power session, which means I have 25 minutes to get across some ideas. So let's just get started. It's 1886, and in your mailbox you receive your copy of the Scientific American Supplement. In there, they talk about a new photographic apparatus. Revolutionary technology going to change the world. It looks a little bit like this. This is essentially in 1886, the leading kind of camera technology. And the article that accompanies it comments on how this is essentially, you know, they don't use the word bleeding edge, but the equivalent of bleeding edge at the time. They call it the most practical of systems for the itinerant photographer, you know, the photographer on the go. And that might be the case, and there's this very nice article here, but if you read this article, it's a little bit like reading bad consumer electronics in terms of the complexity. The door E performs the role of this, and you raise the mirror, and you turn the button, and you go through an apparatus through a door, and the pressure on the springs, and the shutter of the frame, and it was not necessarily something that was easy to use, though at the time it was the easiest to use. And because of the complexity of a system such as this, photography really was in the hands simply of either professionals or really active hobbyists, what you all know as geeks, basically the equivalent of the folks who will be running Dorkbot tonight. So into this mix comes a gentleman named George Eastman. And George Eastman is an inventor, and he invented a new type of film, a roll film. The camera that I showed before used dry plates. And it would have been very easy for George Eastman to simply take his roll film and put it inside a camera that looked like the one that we saw, you know, make it a little bit smaller, a little bit more compact, and done. But he realized that there was a new opportunity that was made available through his new technology. And he kind of captured this opportunity in this phrase, "You press the button and we do the rest." Now, this was an advertising slogan, but it really captured the nature of the experience he wanted to deliver for the customer. And the product that he developed that for is the Kodak camera, released in 1888. And the Kodak camera was a lot easier to use than the one that we saw before. As you can see in this advertisement for the Kodak, there's essentially three steps. Pull the cord, turn the key, press the button. So unlike the 15 to 20 steps we saw before, this was something that almost anybody could use. Now, because of this simplicity, right, the Kodak camera was an amazing success. It was an amazing success, took off, and essentially the history of photography has two periods, before Kodak and after Kodak. I guess there's a third period now with kind of after digital, but for the longest time, that was the only real divide. So, you press the button, and then the Kodak factory in Rochester, New York, does the rest. That's where all the processing and all the film development happened, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that later. So what I'm going to be talking about for the next 20 or so minutes is a series of trends that we've seen at Adaptive Path, both in the work we're doing and just kind of looking at the market wanting to communicate what we're seeing in terms of where things are headed and how you can kind of take advantage of what's going on, particularly in the area of product and services development. Now, if you're developing a new product, you might think to yourself or ask yourself, what's the highest compliment I could receive? It's probably not highly profitable, though that would be a good thing, but, you know, that's not necessarily the highest compliment. It could be never breaks, right? Stability, that's what I want in my product, that it never breaks. But probably the highest compliment that you could receive is something along the lines of cool, right? Cool. Can't live without it. Love it. Want and must have it. Those are the kinds of things that you're aiming for as you develop a product. So, when we were thinking about, you know, cool products, we thought, well, there's a gentleman that we're familiar with who knows a little bit of something about cool products, right? Let's ask Steve what he thinks about product development. And his answer comes in three parts. So we'll talk about the first part here. When you start looking at a problem and it seems really simple with all these simple solutions, you don't really understand the complexity of the problem, and your solutions are way too oversimplified and they don't work. And what Steve's talking about, and one way to look at this kind of three-part series, is that this kind of, at the outset of the development of any product, there's this kind of focus on the technology, on the tools, on the technology that just makes something possible, makes something capable. And oftentimes, especially at the outset, we get very focused on just like, hey, look, we can do this new thing. And this can work early in the history of a product. Take, for example, the VCR, released in the mid-70s, the home VCR. Wasn't sexy, didn't do much, but it did something you could never have done before, right? It recorded television, and that was exciting in and of itself, and you didn't really ask for it to do much more than that, right? So, you know, it might not be much to look at, but, you know, it's interesting and new, and it was able to get some traction because of it. Now, but there's the next step, right? And something happens in the development of these products, and we can, got a little bit mixed up. The VCR, this first VCR, what happens with these new technologies, these bright new technologies, reminds us of a quote from Samuel Johnson, who's considered one of history's great smartasses. Like a dog's walking on his hind legs, it is not done well, but you are surprised to see it done at all. Right? So, whether it was the first VCR, perhaps the first word processor, right? WordStar looked like dog meat, but hey, it was better than using a typewriter. So we used it, right? So let's go back to Steve and listen to the second part of his comment on cool products. Then you get into the problem and you see it's really complicated and you come up with all these convoluted solutions. That's sort of the middle and that's where most people stop, and those solutions tend to work for a while, right? And what we've seen is, like, in this development of a kind of a product category, the next step is this focus on features. And what happens is you get all this convoluted complexity, and technology is no longer the differentiator. Everyone has the same technology, so they're kind of piling on features so they can have more things to list on the box, right? The problem is the logical ending point for that is something that looks like this. And if you were to look at if you were to look at what's on the box, you see a list that looks something like this. And it's got all kinds of features and functionality that no one knows how to use. And so when it sits in people's homes, it looks like that. Right? All that people wanted to do was be able to easily record some TV shows and play them back. And because VCRs got so complex and so overwhelming, they turned essentially into video cassette players where you would just rent stuff and put it in and play it. You didn't use any of that technology because it was too much of a pain in the ass to make work. So one more time, let's get back to Steve and get to the third part of his comment that we've been looking at, which is, but the really great person will keep on going and find the key underlying principle of the problem and come up with a beautiful, elegant solution that works, right? And this sounds like something Steve would say, the Steve who maybe was involved with the design of iPhone or was involved in the design of iPod, but it actually wasn't this Steve who said that. It was this Steve who said that back in 1984 with the launch of Macintosh, right? And so one of the things that's interesting to think about is how this approach is, what you've seen, it's one of mindset, right? Steve clearly has this mindset towards how he delivers products and delivering products really in order to satisfy an experience. To understand the experiential desires of the people using the products and meet those, and starting from the experience instead of starting from the technology or features and trying to figure out how on earth can I make this relevant to somebody. And if we think back to VCRs and how that's evolved, we see a kind of logical next step, which is TiVo. Now, how many folks in the audience have TiVo? Are people, a lot of TiVo folks? And I'm guessing you all probably love it. And that's one of the things that's true about TiVo. TiVo, very similar, I think, to what George Eastman did with the Kodak camera. George, you know, developed a new technology, this roll film, but instead of putting roll film into a smaller version of a difficult to use camera, he realized it afforded him a whole new kind of opportunity for what a camera could be. TiVo, instead of just shoving a hard drive into a VCR, right, realized that by going digital, you could provide a whole new experience that around how people actually want to watch television and engage with their television, such that people who have TiVo have trouble going to a life without TiVo. Probably many of us are probably traveling and staying in a hotel room and very frustrated that you can't hit pause on that stupid TV that they've given you. Right? Now, TiVo might not be the runaway business success some other products are, but I think it's brand presence, the fact that TiVo is becoming kind of like Xerox, where people refer to any DVR as TiVo, right? It's definitely made an impression. This approach, by really understanding what people want to do with it and then designing the experience to satisfy that, clearly is working for them. Now, we can also see this approach in the development of the MP3 player. You probably all knew this was coming. Right. So take the history of the Diamond Rio. Came out in 1998. So it was the first MP3 player to market. It had the technology, had the features. The RIAA tried to get it banned because they were afraid that it was going to, take away all their revenues. And it did okay. It had a marginal uptake. And then 3 years later, iPod came on the scene. 3 years later, there was 3 years for that MP3 market to really develop, in which almost nothing happened. But then in 2001, iPod is released, and the iPod actually does less than a Diamond Rio, costs a boatload more, and totally took over, right? And this is where I present my little caveat. Peter Mieslaw, as a discussion of product design goes longer, the probability of using the iPod as an exemplar approaches one. There's a reason we do it. It makes a lot of sense. So what's going on with the iPod and with TiVo? Why are these successful in ways that some of their competitors are not? Well, it's because that when people interact with products, they are interacting with them as if they were people too. If the folks in here saw Kathy Sierra's talk, right, and all those people wanting to flip off or yell at or whatever their products, that's a very natural reaction. It's not a weird thing that we yell at our products. We react to them as if they were people. There's actually a lot of research behind how this happens, why this happens. I won't be getting into that, but this is true, right? We react to products as if they're people. And you can see this in things like iGuy, right? iGuy is an iPod case, and it kind of makes manifest this relationship that people have with the product. If you read Stephen Levy's book on the iPod, The Perfect Thing, there's some stories in there about 12-year-old girls going to bed with their iPod and treating it as if they're like a sibling or a pet, or someone whose iPod broke and she needed to get a new one, and she was in mourning for 2 days because she lost. It was like losing a friend, right? These are not uncommon reactions. People develop these very kind of strong emotional attachments to their products, and something like iGuy really kind of helps manifest that, right? The designers of TiVo even understood this, right? TiVo is pretty much an abstraction. It's a little more than a hard drive and an interface, but when you look at the identity that they developed for it, they realized the value of personalizing it, or alienizing it as the case may be, but giving it a personality. And I don't know about you, but I am with my TiVo at home, I will sometimes just watch that first screen just to see the little TiVo guy animate, just to see what he's doing, because it's so cute, right? It's a little antennae bow, right? Right. So we have this reaction to products. We have this kind of strange visual reaction to products. Now, if products are people too, we want our products essentially, and if we're designing products and we want our products to be cool, well, what is it about people that makes them cool? What is it about people that makes us gravitate towards them? And oftentimes it's that they know who they are, right? They've got a kind of a firm identity, and they know who they are, and they know what they're about, and we can react to it that way. They have an integrity and consistency to their personalities, so that your entire experience through it, you know, through and through with them, has this integrity to it. They're not trying to be something that they're not. A technology product that doesn't know who it is likely to deliver an experience based on the wrong factors. So this is a conceptual model that we often use when developing software or websites or any kind of software-based product, where you have the data and the data is interpreted by logic, and then the logic is made present to the user through an interface. Now, we as designers and developers understand that, but our users have a very different model. Our users see that interface, and then everything else is magic. I think in a future talk I'll put the floating head of Doug Henning in here. The world of illusion, right? Right? Everything is magic. They don't know what's going on in there, and they don't need to know what's going on there. They shouldn't know what's going on in there. But the problem is, often as we're designing and developing products, we get so focused on the things that make them work that we start designing from the inside out. We start with the data, then into the logic, then to the interface. We lose that experiential orientation. And what we need to do is inverse that. We need to make sure that we are designing from the outside in. We need to make sure that we've identified the experience we want to deliver and figure out how to do so. Right? And designing from the outside in actually is a phrase that came from Tim O'Reilly in this blog post on O'Reilly's Radar, when he was talking about what he was seeing happening in the web applications world. Folks like 37 Signals and some other people mentioned in this article, right? What is the experience we want to deliver? Then figure out what the technology and features are that will support that. Excuse me. So how do we get there? How can we provide products, services that give our audiences this kind of experience orientation? And what we've seen that's starting to catch on more and more is this idea of an experience strategy, right? And the idea of an experience strategy, this is some type of articulated touchstone that can guide a design and development team throughout their process. So if we think back to George Eastman, you press the button and we do the rest, serves as this kind of experience strategy. It's kind of this star to sail the ship by, this point on the horizon to navigate towards. And all the decisions made about technology and features are such that it satisfies this experiential need. A much more recent example that probably is more relevant to the folks here actually comes from the development of Google Calendar. So Google Calendar entered a very saturated calendar market. Yahoo and MSN Hotmail have had calendars out there forever and a pretty decent installed base. And there was a presumption that the success of your calendar was tied to the success of your email. And because Yahoo and Hotmail are just so much, have so many more users than Gmail, there was a lot of suspicion that Google could really accomplish much there. And before they did anything, before they started writing any code, before they started designing any screens, they developed this vision. And this slide actually came from a talk that the product manager, Carl Silgreen, gave at the Future of Web Applications last year, right? And they articulated this vision in a way that they're trying to capture the experience that they want to deliver. What is the experience that the customer is going to have? Build a calendar that works for you, fast, visually appealing, joyous, drop-dead simple, more than boxes on a screen, easy to share so you can see your whole life in one place. Designed for a consumer world where not everyone has a calendar or one on the same system, right? So they had this vision, this vision driven by the experience that they wanted to deliver. And to their credit, it seems to have done pretty well. Because in the first 8 months, Google went from zero to the number two calendar in the market, surpassing MSN Hotmail. And this is Yahoo, on whose heels they are nipping. That's what I meant to say. Right? So by taking a very different approach, that allows you to potentially leapfrog in what could be seen as a saturated marketplace. Just show some photos. This is from a project that we worked on in Adaptive Path, where we were doing some work with the client in the financial services sector. Oh, wow, I have 5 minutes. Okay, we're going to go much faster. Working with a client in the financial services sector, we interviewed a lot of folks, observed how they did their work, realized the complexity of the work they were doing. We were able to distill it to this set of design requirements right here. This actually served as that star for us to sail our ship by. It's probably not the most obvious thing to those out in the audience, and if I had more time, I'd explain it more in detail, but this was the experience that people wanted to have with the product, and so we made sure the design satisfied that. The problem was that the website was only part of a much larger experience that was broken. And what our client was not doing was leveraging a system. They were trying to develop a singular standalone product. And the other thing that we've noticed is that you have to leverage the system. Again, back to Eastman Kodak, the complexity of photography was not reduced overall, right? Those 17 steps are still happening. Many of them are happening, though, elsewhere, right? So that's part of the secret. How do you place the functionality where it is appropriate? Again, iPod. iPod is an extremely impoverished tool, does almost nothing, but it can do almost nothing because it is designed to work with a piece of software that does a whole lot more. And that piece of software also has within it the ability to do even more through the iTunes store. And so because the way they've managed these components, the iPod is essentially a device for playing, iTunes is a device for managing, and the music store is this device for acquiring. All of these coordinate into a system, right? So one of the things to think about is how can you figure out where functionality can be most appropriately placed? Now, we don't always have control over the system. Let's say we're trying to enter the world of digital photography, and there's cameras, and there's software, and there's mobile phones, and there's people wanting prints, and there's people wanting blogs, right? Pretty messy world where there was nothing much to help coordinate it until Flickr came in. And Flickr actually, Flickr's probably single biggest attribute, or one of its biggest attributes, is how it helps coordinate all this kind of mess that was the digital photography market. The reason that they're able to do that, or a reason they're able to do that, is if you go to the About page on Flickr, you see it's a little bit hard to see, it's off the screen, right? This is their star to sail their ship by. And I had Katarina Fake on stage a couple weeks ago for a conference and asked her about this. And she talked about how important it was that they articulated their vision so that they always knew what they were doing as they moved forward in the design and development process. That vision allowed them to coordinate all that mess into kind of a discrete set of, I don't know what's going on with the lights. so trying to keep you awake. Right? It allowed kind of this ability to make coherent that chaos, right? By focusing on this vision, right? By making sure every decision is made that either helps people make photos available to the people who matter to them or helps them organize it. By running that as a filter on all decisions, it allows you to make something that could be chaotic and make it coherent. This is what was missing in the work that we were doing with our client, where because each of these were essentially siloed, right? The financial statement that you got every month, using the website, using a call center, using the branch, each of these felt like it had to do everything. They weren't leveraging the system. They weren't figuring out what can a monthly statement do on paper that only a monthly statement can do. What can a website do that only the website can do? And instead, each of these tried to do everything, and it created this chaos for their customers. So, to wrap up, what Kodak, Google Calendar, Flickr, and Apple have realized is that both today and tomorrow, the most successful products and services are those who know who they are and will deliver on a cohesive experience strategy, because the experience is the product we deliver and the only thing that your customers care about. And with that, I thank you.